Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Hey, thanks for being with us this evening. My guest today is someone you may know from television. She's on CNN. She's on The Doctors. We're going to have Dr. Wendy Walsh with us in just a few minutes. But first, today's metaphysical musing. So usually in this little metaphysical musing thing, I talk about metaphysics or shamanism or whatever comes to mind at the time. But I really want to talk about one of the key things that I want to do with the show and why having Wendy on the show is exciting. People tend to look at folks who are successful, and in most cases, the folks on this show are masters of some spiritual skill. You know, they're psychics and healers and do all kinds of interesting, strange things. But Wendy is another kind of success story, and she has a background that most people would never in a million years figure out. And I had the pleasure of meeting Wendy on Facebook and in private messages, kind of having a conversation about how'd you get here? What's going on? And I just find her background absolutely fascinating. And I think it will tell you a lot about how to understand the life path of anyone who is a master of anything. And for Wendy, obviously, it got her to where she is as an expert on TV. So without any more conversation about metaphysics, I'd like to introduce Wendy Walsh. And let's have some fun. Hey, Wendy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I'm so excited to have you on the show. We kind of waited while your big announcement of being on The Doctors came through, the big mystery.
I know. Everything has to be done on its television schedule.
I totally understand, and I'm really thankful that the media folks at The Doctors approved that you could be on with me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for those of you out there that don't know Wendy, she's the psychologist that is consulted with on CNN, and she's the psychologist on the show The Doctors. But there's so much more about her. And if you do know her from television, you know that she is a stunning, tall blonde. And
Not my fault.
Which you always say, and that's part of your story that I find totally fascinating. And you know, I don't know where you want to start the story, but your nickname when you were a kid I thought was great, because you've got both sides of it. You've got beauty, which is both an advantage and a disadvantage depending on the situation. And you're also wicked smart.
Well, I think I came from a really good educational environment. You know, all we are squishy bits of biology that are pummeled onto this planet and put into an environment that includes our parents, our extended family of origin, our friends, our peers, our school system, and that squishy piece of biology, all the genetic potential can be enlivened or it can be suppressed. So I happen to come from a pretty good educational system in Canada where education is expected, rewarded. And in America, we place way too much emphasis on physical beauty, whether it's female physical beauty or male athletic prowess. You know, there's no such thing as a sports scholarship at a university in Canada. So it's like an oxymoron, a sports scholarship. I don't get that. But what ends up happening, I think, in American culture is that attractive people or people with great athletic prowess are steered away from the hard sciences and the strict educational tracks. And I was fortunate that that didn't happen to me because I didn't come here till I was 25.
Uh-huh. So being Canadian, I actually was coached by a friend on how to pronounce that correctly, A. has made a big difference and really puts you in a different situation compared to Americans. But so you got, did you get your doctorate in Canada? Because you have a PhD.
No, I went back to school in midlife when I was home nursing a baby, my first child. It started when I was pregnant with my first. And I was trying to figure out, I'd had a big TV career behind me. I was a news anchor and TV host. And I hunkered down with those pregnancy hormones and started reading, starting those just pregnancy books, what's going on with my body, and then brain development books as I thought about what I could be ingesting that could be affecting her brain development, and then parenting books. And the more I read, the more I said, oh, I better start taking some classes on this because it really, human behavior, human development, fascinated me. So I took a few classes, and one led to another and to another and to another. And by the time I weaned that baby and had a second one, I went, holy camoli, I have enough credits to be a master's degree. Maybe I should just continue and do a PhD. So that's what I did. But I really just let my interests lead me. I didn't start off saying, I am going to be a doctor of psychology. I started off taking a class that was interesting to me, and then that led to another one. Of course, the downside is that I saved all the awful courses, the brain physiology, the statistic classes for the very end. It was awful the last year.
Yeah, I totally understand that one. And you're a single mom. You've got two kids.
I'm a single mom. Yep, so, I have a now teenager daughter who's 13, and I have an 8-year-old, and I've been single for 6 years. So it's just been the three of us doing things, and my littlest one is in the autistic spectrum, which I always say that when we have special needs kids, they're such a gift to us because they teach us so much about ourselves, about patience and boundaries and everything else.
I sort of knew the ages of your kids. I didn't know that your younger daughter was special needs. Fascinating that you got a doctorate in psychology before that child was born, which gave you a lot of information you needed. So,
it did, but you know, autism certainly isn't my specialty, and I still depend on the specialist. It's not my specialty to know autism. I really think that my best role for my daughter is not as her doctor, but as her mother.
Right. Right. And so what would you say your specialty is in psychology?
My specialty is an area of psychology called attachment theory. And attachment theory looks at the way that we attach to primary caregivers in early life and how that becomes hardwired into our brain so that we tend to repeat these patterns over and over and over through our life. Not just in romantic attachment, but also even in workplace and friendship attachment. So I look at the way we attach to everything, people, things, pets, our children, and where the functionality is and the dysfunction is in those attachment patterns.
And so is that the research that you've done? Because I know you've done...
Yeah, my research subject for my dissertation was I staged a one-year study on... I took a population of 100 pregnant women, and I gave them an instrument, a test, to determine what their own internal romantic attachment style was. There's like four general categories they could have fallen into: securely attached, anxiously attached, ambivalent, avoidant. And then I caught up with them at 4 months postpartum, and I looked at how often and to what degree and in what manner they were breastfeeding or not. And I was able to make a correlation between those who were more avoidant attachment style, meaning that they tend to really avoid intimacy. It's intolerable to them, because I think the breastfeeding relationship is probably the most intimate relationship of our entire lifespan. I mean, men love to think that it's a sexual relationship, but the last time I checked, you know, only a good sexual person might go for an hour. But a newborn baby latches onto your body. You're feeding it physiologically. You are staring into it with eye contact. You are stroking its body. You are cuddling and having deep intimacy. For if you add up all the feedings, it's about 8 hours in a 24-hour period for a newborn. So it's day after day after day. So it's a very intimate relationship. And I had this theory that a lot of women can't tolerate that level of intimacy because we're seeing so much just intimacy intolerance. We haven't been taught to be close in our culture.
Right, right. Are you seeing more women breastfeed? And you're seeing a correlation between the women that don't breastfeed and the issues that you identified?
I was able to make a correlation in my dissertation, but only lightly, not with statistical probability, because people who are avoidant and avoid intimacy also avoid participating in these kinds of psychological studies. I would be handing out my flyers at labor prep classes and labor yoga classes, and I would watch them walking out the back door as I'm handing out my flyers going like, you're the ones I need.
Right.
But they don't want to take tests about emotional intimacy. So, right. But I am seeing in general in our culture, we're seeing a higher, we have a highest amount of breastfeeding since, you know, probably the lowest amount of breastfeeding in our culture was about 1974, 75. And now it's starting to come back up, but mostly in affluent women, because there's a crazy misperception that low-income women or immigrant women think that wealthy white women use the powder, as they call it, formula. And so it must be better. And it's a complete misconception that it's better. So, you know, our mandate is really to educate women of all classes to understand that nothing's better than breast milk, both for nutrition, but I'm more concerned about the psychological piece, the teaching of bonding and intimacy.
Mm-hmm. So one of the – well, tell the audience a little bit about what you do on CNN and on The Doctors and, you know, how you're positioned and all of that and the stuff that you talk about.
On CNN and HLN, I'm a general human behavior expert. We just look at all the things going on in the news, whether they want me to do an armchair diagnosis of Gaddafi or whether they have video of a crazy violent event that took place in a McDonald's and how this employee could have gone crazy on you know, what happened in his aggression or poor impulse control, or celebrity relationships or just trends going on in our culture. So that's every Saturday at 2:15 Pacific, 5:15 Eastern on CNN Newsroom. And then throughout the week, they just use me sporadically on all their shows when they have something breaking. I mean, I did a lot of press this week on this terrible story of a Chinese toddler in China who was run over twice by cars and no one came to her aid for like 17 minutes. I really broke down what bystander effect is because let me tell you this, David, if you need a medical assistance or help from the police and you're in an urban center, you better hope that there are very few people around. Because statistically speaking, the more people around to witness your tragedy, the less likely you are to get help. And that's bystander effect.
Right. Everybody thinks somebody else is going to do something.
Right. And they also take their cues of how to behave by how others are behaving.
Uh-huh.
Pick up the social cues from everybody else. Well, they're not doing anything, so maybe we don't do anything here. I don't know.
Is that across all cultures, or do you think that?
Yeah, bystander effect has been shown to show up in all cultures.
Interesting.
You know, one of the questions, I think it was a Canadian news organization asked me, it was because there's like less Christianity in China or something, that somehow they don't have the Good Samaritan story to guide them. But, you know, every religion in the world has some form of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have to do unto yourself. So, no, you know, it's just sort of a phenomenon of groups of people watching and trying to, you know, take action or not.
Right. And it was particularly shocking because it involved a small child. And
yes. But here in America, I mean, the whole idea was coined back in the 70s with Kitty Genovese, the young woman who was murdered in New York, while 38 people reported watching it from their apartment windows.
Right.
Nobody called the police. Yeah.
Right. Of course, that was before cell phones with cameras, because everyone would have been videoing the event.
Well, that's the other thing, is that sometimes they video tragedy without helping.
Right, exactly. It always surprises me, some of the things you find on YouTube, where my immediate response is, why are you taking a video instead of doing something about this?
Why aren't you doing something? Exactly.
So, and on The Doctors...
And on The Doctors, I'm the most recent co-host. This season, we have the addition of Jillian Michaels, health and wellness expert and trainer extraordinaire, and myself, to finally add a little bit of a mental health piece to the biological science that they've been talking about for the last 3 years. And it's a nationally syndicated show in Los Angeles. It airs on CBS at 2 o'clock every day and in New York at 9 a.m. every day. And the rest of your country, check your local listings.
And I have caught you several times on The Doctors. It's a very interesting show. Do you find that your point of view and Jillian's are very different on some issues?
Yes and no. I think that she's, I have to say I love her to death. And if I could have her like as my full-time roommate, I would love it. If only because my kitchen would be so organic and clean and perfect. But she is very parochial and I believe has great intentions in telling people how to live healthy lives without exception. And I'm a more believer that good enough is good enough. And when you're a mother and you're driving kids around and you've got one screaming and taking a tantrum in the back because she's special needs and you've got another one who's late for her science project group you've got to get her to and the other one's got to get to cheerleading and those golden arches come looming in front of you and you know there's an instant solution to your pain, you're going to take a break every now and again and pull into those golden arches. Now, Jillian would argue, well, you should have planned for this at 5 a.m. and packed the organic nut butter on the whole grain bread and had it ready for them. But of course, she doesn't have children yet, so she doesn't
know.
Right,
exactly. I was going to say that spoken exactly like someone who doesn't have kids.
Exactly.
who really
love her. And her message of health and wellness is such a good, pure one, and her intentions are so pure. She just wants the absolute best for everybody. She's a doll.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me, her bark is worse than her bite.
Right. I mean, my joke with you on Facebook was, don't worry, you can take her.
Right.
So, and actually, that's where we first met was on Facebook. And one of the things that I found fascinating is you tend to post something about a research that has recently been released and ask a question about it. And frequently I'm one of the people that either argues with the way you ask the question or disagrees with your point of view.
Love about my Facebook pages and, you know, my personal page is full now. So we have to direct people to my fan page where I am equally as active on. And you get to there by going to my website, which is drwendywalsh.com. But the thing I love about all my Facebook pages is that it is a really open forum for free opinions, and I really respect everybody's opinion. The only posts I would ever delete are racist ones. It's the only thing I can't tolerate. And other than that, I might very publicly wrap someone's fingers if I think they're being rude to another Facebook follower and starting to do personal attacks. But other than that, you know, voice your opinion. That's the place to do it. That's a nice, safe place to rant.
And I've seen many, many rants on your Facebook page. It's really fascinating. But you do come up with research studies that I just find completely fascinating.
I search the internet every day for the latest human behavior studies coming out of university. And as much as I would love to, it's interesting to me to read about new advances in neurobiology as shown up on MRIs. Actually, what people mostly like to read are differences in genders, why men behave one way and why women behave the other, or sexuality or relationship studies, or studies about parenting that contain really usable information.
So one of the things, at some point you posted something and I sent you a private message and I went, oh, now I get it. You are so smart. You're way ahead of anybody on who's posting on the board. And you shared.
I don't know what I put.
I don't remember what it was either, but it was the beginning of our actually having real conversations online. And you shared with me your nickname when you were a kid, but at some point, do you remember it, or should I tell you what you told me?
I remember it because that's what people have been calling me.
Right. Are you willing to share it with the audience? Cause,
sure. People have always called me Nerd Barbie because I happen to look like a Barbie doll, but I'm very geeky inside. So it's confusing for people because they expect one thing and they get another. Interestingly enough, if I was 5 feet tall with short, dark hair and glasses, no one would blip an eyelid. And so that's one of the things that frustrates me about our culture in general is that we make these crazy prejudgments about people based on what they look like, both positive or negative. But what like what I say about race is if you know somebody's race, you know about as much about them as if you know their shoe size.
Right.
It really tells you nothing until you really get to know their culture. and right. where they come from.
Their culture, their personal history, their life experience,
yeah, exactly.
where they are now. Mm-hmm. So you've really got the two things that I watch young women struggle with, which is part of why I wanted to pick your brain. My daughter is gorgeous. And mm-hmm. people are constantly saying to me, oh, I saw your kid. I feel so bad for you. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? You know, she's gorgeous. She's smart. She's all the wonderful things that she is. Why would I feel bad? And they go, oh, you're going to have to fight the boys off. And I was like, so I should worry, right? And they're like, yeah, you should be. Here we're getting into the metaphysical side of this. My perspective is whatever you focus on with emotion and attention, you get more of. You attract it to you.
You know, one time I took a high-performance race car driving course. Don't ask me why or how I ended up there. And they told me that whatever you look at is where you'll drive to. You drive with your eyes, not with your arms. Your arms are just following. So if you see yourself heading towards a crash, they don't tell you to turn away from it. They say look away from it.
Right. Look away from the wall. Look away from the wall. If you're heading for the wall, look away from the wall. And what most people in most situations do is they look at the wall and go, oh, my God, I'm going to hit the wall.
And they do.
And they do. And then they get to be right and they get to complain about it for a long time. Exactly like race car driving, what people focus on, they get. So if you worry about something, you're repeatedly emotionalizing a focus on what you don't want, and in effect looking at the wall and screaming, and then you get it and everybody goes, see, I told you it was terrible. So I don't worry about my kid. I just, you know that she's going to be safe and tell her constantly how wonderful she is.
I think the thing as parents that we need to do, especially if we have attractive children or athletic children in this culture that rewards it in a very strange way, is to simply reward the other things.
Right.
Ignore the thing that the rest of the world is rewarding anyway, and reward intelligence and kindness.
Right, right. And for her, she's not an athlete, but she's a dancer. So, you know, she's got a presence when she comes into the room because of all the body knowledge that she's got. That's exactly what I do. Now, the flip side is being a very intelligent woman, which also is something that confounds most people in this culture, at least in the United States, you know, not expecting it, but also, well, now what do you do with the cognitive dissonance of this woman is stunningly beautiful and she's incredibly smart. How do you stand there in the presence of that? But from your side of it, what are the issues that come up as a woman who's really smart and the expectations of the people around you? And what do you tell young women about how to navigate being really smart in this culture?
Well, I think in business and in your personal life, it's two different concepts. Obviously, in business, showcase your brain, because that's ultimately going to be the thing that gets rewarded. But in your personal life, I'm a big believer in sort of not fighting biology. In other words, some people think I'm a big believer in traditional gender roles. I'm not. I mean, I believe in a big variety of gender roles, and any gender can use whatever gender role feels good to them. But I think right now we're fighting so much to try to make the genders so equal that we're denying a lot of really important gender-related behaviors. So in personal life, people get mad at me all the time when I say this, but I'm like, girlfriend, you do not need to compete with your guy. If you are really that smart and you really make that amount of money, you don't need to flaunt it in front of him, because that's not going to create self-esteem in him and make him the king that you want. And I think that the people who compete with others, especially in personal relationships, are people who actually feel insecure about themselves.
Right.
So if you, you know, it's like, if you got to say it, then maybe it ain't so. So I do advise women in their personal lives to zip it, because it's just showing their insecurity if they feel that they have to brag and show off, whether it is about their, you know, the level of business that they're in, the amount of money they make, or their amount of brain power.
Right. As somebody who likes very intelligent women, one of the things I realized is people say that confidence is sexy. And I realized that for me, it's competence that's sexy. Watching somebody who can do something that's complicated and do it with great skill without thinking about it, that has just got mastery over whatever it is, whether it's a man or a woman.
It's funny you should bring this up, because I just wrote a blog this morning for AskMen.com where I was researching a phenomenon from sports psychology and applying it to business and relationship skills. And the phenomenon is called a stereotypical identity, or identifying with stereotypes within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Let me explain. Studies have shown that if women are taking a math test and they're told just before the math test that one of the reasons why they've been given this test is they're comparing genders, how genders do on a test, then women will always score worse if they're given that priming or that prompt. Mm-hmm. If male white engineers are given the same math test and told that they're comparing genders, the white male engineers score better. But if those same white male engineers are told that they're actually comparing them with Asian engineers, those white male engineers score worse. So
interesting.
The point is, we all have parts of our personalities. Every single part of our personality can be discriminated against. But if we buy into any piece of that discrimination, that's the calling card we walk in the door with. So
right.
One of the techniques for athletes, for instance, is to identify with the highest part of themselves and bring that to the game. And, you know, I am a pro. I can do this. I've won so many Super Bowls. This is just another one. And in business and personal life, for everyday life, for people, it's about identifying with the things you love the most about yourself, being proud of those things, and bringing it into the room. Because you're talking about self-confidence. Self-confidence is infectious. Everybody mm-hmm. wants a piece of it.
Right.
And the way to create it is to reframe some of the negative thoughts inside yourself. If you believe that old age is old age and it's not highly valuable wisdom, then guess what? You're going to be discriminated against by ageism.
Right.
You know, if you believe that a study that came out of a university yesterday, I can't remember if I posted it or not, was that women who believe in gender stereotypes, like women are not good at this or not good at that, tend to be the most hesitant investors in their investment portfolio. They don't take risks. They're not risk tolerant. They don't gamble. They don't trust their instincts, if you will.
Interesting.
So that's what self-confidence is. It's very, really, really simple. It's finding what you like best about yourself and, playing that card first. And secondly, looking at the things that where there might be discriminatory voices inside yourself and reframing it, turning it around, turning it upside down on its head.
Well,
what I do.
The other thing I'm hearing in this is the placebo effect and the nocebo effect. So after the break, we're going to take a short break in a minute. I want to kind of go in that direction. But tell people again where they can find you online.
They should go to my website, drwendywalsh.com, and from there they can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, my YouTube channel, wherever they want.
She's everywhere, and which is great. So we will be back shortly with Dr. Wendy Walsh here on the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Don't go away.
As long as we have
hope, prayer, and a little bit of time to get us there. Hope, prayer, and time.
As long as we have
hope, prayer, and a little bit of time to get us there. Hope, prayer, and time.
World Wildlife Fund. Working around the world to build a future where people live in harmony with nature.
People.
For more than 40 years, World Wildlife Fund has achieved lasting conservation results by working with local governments, communities, businesses, and scientists to save wildlife and wild places. Please help us save the world's most endangered animals and places. Go to worldwildlife.org today. Thank you.
want to change some things.
I want the moms where I live to have childcare they can trust.
I want to make sure my little brother and his friends have a safe place to play.
I want to help more kids graduate from high school.
Help more hardworking families learn how to budget and save.
I want more of my neighbors to have access to health care.
Want to make a difference? There are so many ways you can. Help create opportunities for everyone in your community.
I want to change what I see around here.
United Way is creating real, lasting change where you live by focusing on the building blocks of a better life: education, income, and health.
I mean, I just want to see more smiles on my sidewalks.
Reach out a hand to one and influence the condition of all. Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. For more, visit United Way at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Play ball!
Now pitching, Dave Black.
Dave is about to catch his opponent off guard. Not with his nasty fastball, no. Instead of a fastball, Dave will be hurling a tomato.
And the pitch.
Ooh. Using tomatoes as baseballs won't go over well with anyone. But if you're looking to hit the ball further and throw better, eating a healthy diet that includes fruits and vegetables is a home run. Packed with nutrients, they could help keep your body healthy and strong, giving you the energy you need to hit that grand slam. When you look at it this way, eating tomatoes is playing hardball against the competition. Run, throw, think, eat better. Can your food do that? Find out at smallstep.gov.
That's smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the...
With David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
You're back with Dr. Wendy Walsh. And just before the break, I was thinking about the way that you were talking about the previous topic and realizing you're really in many ways talking about the placebo effect and its dark twin, the nocebo effect, which people don't talk about a whole lot, but is pretty much as well researched as placebo. So placebo is you get an effect because people believe that that's the outcome that will happen. And the nocebo is you get a negative effect because that's what people are expecting to happen.
Right. Or a negative placebo. Right.
Right.
I mean, placebo in the hard biological science, it's pretty well known to be close to 30%, depending on the study. Mm-hmm. So that's why people in the alternative healing communities often work hard to encourage positive placebos as a healing technique, because
right.
they know that the body can do a lot on its own with mind over matter.
And in the same way, we live in a culture that is so permeated, so completely filled with negative messages and fear messages that, from my perspective, people are having the nocebo effect on so many aspects of their life, and it's constant, and it's coming from all directions.
It's called modern capitalism. You can't sell a product until you convince people that they need a product. And
right.
the way to convince the people that they need the product is you have to convince them that they have a problem. There's something wrong with them until they buy this thing, whether it's a shirt or an ointment or a car.
Right. Or any political position or any political candidate or the war du jour or whatever it is that's being sold.
Right.
So from... In the studies that you've been looking at and your perspective on all of this, how is that affecting people and what can people do about living in this fear soup and counteracting it?
Well, I think that, you know, I spend a lot of time coaching and counseling people to understand that there's a difference between who they are and what was done to them. Whether I'm talking about early childhood trauma or whether I'm talking about the assault of commercialism that's turned our population into consumers. So you have to separate yourself out from your culture as much as possible and realize that just because this advertisement that's trying to sell you a product or this politician that's trying to sell you a way of thinking or whatever is is trying to beat you up, but you have to know who you are separate from all of that first. And of course, those of us who had really positive parents who did not practice critical parenting are in the minority, where we have a sense of self. And the rest of us, the rest of the people in America, had critical parents who basically tried to shape their behavior by telling them what was wrong with them. I mean, my parents happened to shape my behavior by telling me, by rewarding what was right about me. And I continued, you know, going for that carrot. So it's a matter of reparenting yourself, if you will, with voices that reward yourself for things that are great. And then you'll be less susceptible to all these external pressures and external criticisms.
Right. And also becoming aware of how they do it. I started teaching my daughter when she was 4 how to decipher what was going on in commercials. It's like, watch.
Right.
They're going to tell you that something's wrong. They're going to try and get you upset about it, and then they're going to tell you they can fix it if you buy what they're selling, which is every commercial, except they're getting more sophisticated in the emotional aspects of it lately.
And they're going to use really pretty, happy people. So
right.
That you'll think, I'll be that pretty and that happy if I have that thing.
Right. The ones that are getting to me the most lately are the ones for skin collagen products that show 20-year-olds. Right. And they're saying that at age 20, your skin starts to change. And they're showing these kids that are 16 as the ones that are selling the skin collagen improving product. I'm like, excuse me?
Well, they're just trying to continue to broaden their marketplace. I think the stuff marketed to men, the beauty products marketed to men, are hysterical because they've just run out of women to sell creams and potions to. So now they've turned all these guys into metrosexuals worried about hair in the wrong places or the wrong color hair or the wrong skin, and it cracks me up. I'm like, oh, my God. Now capitalism has turned men into girls.
Right. Look at your husband. Look at me. Look at your. At least those commercials are silly and funny, but they work anyway.
I was in a pharmacy the other day looking at hair color, and there was a box called Dye for Guys, and I was cracking up at the names they use that are still sort of like trying to be tough, but it's feminizing men.
Right. Right. Well, and then there are all the biological things that are going on that are feminizing men. All the foods that we eat that tend to act like estrogen and reduce testosterone levels and all kinds of things. Most of the vices that are supposed to be macho actually don't work really well for men.
That's funny.
Drinking, smoking, doing drugs, all the rest of it.
Oh, no. I wrote a blog recently for AskMen.com. I read a lot for AskMen about, why we have half the sperm count that men in the 1940s and 50s had.
Right.
And all the environmental factors leading up to that. There's a whole host of list of things. One study was done on male train commuters in Europe. And first they thought it was some kind of radiation they were getting from the high-speed trains. But, oh, no. It was the laptops sitting on their balls.
Right, right.
So,
and, you know, the toxic stuff in the air and the water and everything else, and people are like, oh, that's no big deal, la, la, la. It's very small amounts. And yeah, but it's a small amount for your whole life.
Right.
So very interesting. But my usual perspective, the stuff I usually look for is the emotional and psychological toxicity that's out there, and how people are being poisoned against themselves and what's going on. I know that they call you in. You mentioned being called in to talk about Gaddafi and his personality and all of that. Since I'm in another realm and most of my work is doing psychic stuff and clearing people to move things forward, getting rid of things that you would look at as being psychological issues and other things, but that I can literally see coded energetically and help with. When someone like Gaddafi or a serial killer or some other very visible, violent person is in the news, the first thing I do is check to see if they have the same pattern that I've seen in so many others. And it, my way of looking at it is seeing the energy pattern. But what's frequently going on is that they're being influenced by someone or something else. They are so far, you would probably think of it as being dissociated, but they're so far out of their body, in the language that I would use, so ungrounded and out of their body, that something else is influencing them to do things. And it's basically the energy pattern of a sociopath. Mm-hmm. They're not present, their heart isn't open, and they're very open to suggestibility, mind control, all the other things that are readily available to manipulate people. And I wonder if
I was actually reading a study this morning on personalities of psychopaths, and it suggests that 1% of the population are considered psychopaths, and 25% of male inmates fall into, you know, there's actually a checklist, believe it or not. And if you pay attention to their language, those that are diagnosed, they tend to be focused on just plain, simple, besides clearly a lack of empathy and compassion, but real concrete needs for just food, water, alcohol, warmth, money, very simplistic, animalistic kinds of needs.
I wonder if that's also true, but with a different set of needs, a more sophisticated set of needs, for some of the people on Wall Street and the people who have manipulated the economy, even politicians, that they still fit that sociopath psychopathic pattern, but their needs hierarchy is a little more sophisticated. They're more focused on money and money, attention, power, that kind of thing.
But well, I think their personal identity is so much attached to the ladder that's been presented to them. So they tend to be more externally referenced than internally. So, for instance, if you or I do something that doesn't feel quite right, we don't wait until someone gives us a disapproving look. We've already felt something in our stomach and said, oh, that didn't feel quite right, and we've adjusted our behavior. But I would venture to guess that, and it's, you know, hard to generalize about a whole population of people,
right,
but I'd venture to guess that many of them are more externally motivated than internally motivated. And then once they get on that track where they're constantly externally motivated by a new cue, you've got to make more, you've got to have a bigger house, new cue, then they become completely distanced from all the other voices who may be giving them other cues. I was watching a documentary on sort of the fall of Wall Street, and it was saying that one of these presidents of these big investment banking companies, literally his feet never touched the ground except for 10 steps from his armored black SUV where bodyguards escorted him to his private elevator to the 40-something floor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then he went back down to go up another elevator to his high apartment in the sky. He literally never touched ground except for less than 30 seconds a day. We become so
right,
separated from those who might give you cues about something else.
Right, right. And there's just no way of understanding. And those people are literally far away because they're outside of the glass. They're literally below them because they're always in a penthouse.
That's why I'm a huge, huge proponent of making sure, and if it means you have to move, change jobs, put your kids in a different school, whatever you need to do, ensuring that your world is multicultural. And it's hard in some pockets of America that tend to be very homogeneous. But I think we will get a much better perspective on life if we listen to the voices of many who come from different standpoints and have different ideas. We'll be better
right,
people for it.
Right. Well, there's a very minor version of that that happens to people in very hot cities. My best friend lives in Atlanta, or as it's called, Hotlanta. And I say, how's the weather? He says, I don't know. I go from my air-conditioned apartment through the garage to my air-conditioned car. I park outside but in covered parking. Then I get on an elevator and go up to my cube. and I'm in air conditioning all day. I go to the mall for lunch because it's too hot to go outside. I have no idea what the weather is.
Right.
You know, he lives in a completely...
The same thing happens in the north. I'm Canadian. People
right.
live inside in heated bubbles.
Right. Right. I used to have friends in Arizona that gave me a hard time about living in New England and how could I tolerate the winter. And I would just say, what time of day do you go food shopping? They said 5 a.m. before the sun comes up because by 8 it's 106. Go, okay, I rest my case.
That's what I love about California, the moderate climate, not hot, not cold.
Right. Right. I have a friend in Australia who loves the summer there when it's 100 degrees and 100% humidity. And my brain shuts down at about 85.
Mm-hmm. And, but I think what you're talking about is how climate can create a distance from other people.
Right.
And certainly there's far more face-to-face contact on the streets of New York City than there are on the streets of Los Angeles that is a car culture.
Right.
So I think it's really important. But people do, even when they're in those air-conditioned or heated environments, they're in their little bubbles called cars, getting to places where there are other people. So whether it's a school, a college, whether you're going to a workplace, do your best to make sure you're exposing yourself to a multicultural experience.
Right. And just other people. There are so many people who really live isolated lives because of all of that. They go from work to whatever shopping they need to do to home without really having a whole lot of exposure to other people that they get to talk to. They're around people, but they don't really have a whole lot of interaction, which is not just sad, but causes all kinds of problems.
Well, we also have seen an unprecedented rise in the last few decades of single people, single adults.
Yes.
It used to
yes.
be that most adults were married by the time they were 25, 26 years old. But there are plenty of adults who go through their entire lifespan and never get married and live alone now.
Right.
So, and that's very, it's kind of a product of, kind of culture that didn't put a lot of positive reinforcement on having close family ties. In fact, what we needed more than anything was a fluid workforce who wouldn't be dragged down by their family and could move very easily. And
right.
at the end, we promote moving babies from womb to dorm room in a very quick, separated kind of way.
Right.
And thinking that we're making independent people and that making independent people is the best thing. But actually, healthy relationships are built on interdependence. So it's a whole different concept.
Right. And the same, and that's been more true in this generation for women, since women can now make a living, be independent. It's not stigmatized as it was two generations ago. It's more of an issue for women than it ever was before.
I don't think so much that women are choosing to be single. I think that men are choosing more and more not to marry, and that's where we're seeing the decline of traditional marriage. And that's a direct offshoot of the rise in power of women, because whenever women rise in power in a culture, you will see a decline in traditional marriage. The reason being is that sex becomes in high supply. Sex is in very low supply, and virginity is valued. When women have to withhold their sexuality in order to get a man to sign on the dotted line and support them and their offspring. But when women can extract their own resources from the environment, have their own career, make their own money, and indeed honor their own sexuality and have sex with whoever they want to, then men, unfortunately, go, well, why should I sign up for one cow? I can buy the whole herd. So women don't understand that their actual sexual practices have caused this population of unmarrying men. And then they're saying, why can't I get a guy to commit? Oh, he doesn't need to.
Exactly.
Not that I'm advising women to completely withhold their sexuality, but they have to understand it's a whole new landscape now.
Right. Well, this conversation, as always, has been totally fascinating, and I hope we can continue our conversations online and perhaps hear some more. Tell people again where they can find you.
They can find me at drwendywalsh.com. That's DrWendy. WALSH.com. And from there, you can click through and find me on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show, Wendy. Just want to tell folks how to get in touch with me. If you want more information about what I do, you can go to househealing.com, househealing.com, and you'll find my information cleverly hiding on the contact page. So, Wendy, thanks again so much for being on the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Thanks for listening.